Welcome back to the programme. Now, this week we learned that the vast majority of suspended drivers are not surrendering their licences and that procedures to keep qualified drivers off the road are not working. Well, Moya Murdoch is CEO of the Road Safety Authority. She's on the line. And Conor Lally, Crime and Security Editor with the Irish Times, has also joined us here in studio. Moya, can we start? Can you explain all this to us?
Good morning, Marion.
Morning
well,
to you.
Yes, I think some people may have heard this information before. Others may be hearing it for the first time. But it is a problem in this country that when drivers are disqualified, they haven't been surrendering their licence to the RSA post-disqualification. But it is a complex issue, and there's a number of reasons why people continue to behave in that way. And I think what may have been missed in the discussion is the fact that a significant percentage of these drivers do not actually hold a valid licence in the first place, or may actually have already been disqualified and have allowed their licence to expire. And there's a variety of reasons. Only about 40% of people who were disqualified in the year 2017, for example.
Yeah, give me the details on 2017. Can you give us the details on 2017, please?
Yes, Marion. Approximately 9,400 people were disqualified that year. And on average, we do see about 10,000 court disqualifications every year. 45% of those drivers were identified as holding a valid licence, meaning it was in order, and when they got caught committing an offence that warranted a disqualification, their licence was in date, was a full licence, and they were identified in court as the owner of that licence. But a third of those people that were disqualified actually had no record of ever having held an Irish licence. And the Department of Transport hold the database, the National Driver and Vehicle File in Shannon. And if you have a licence, if you've ever held a licence, from the day you became a learner driver right through your whole driving career, you will be held in that database. And there was a further 22% of those drivers who were disqualified had allowed their licence to expire. And that could have been for a number of reasons, because across those 50% of people, some of them had already received a disqualification prior to this. And we do know every year approximately there are about 20,000 active disqualifications. So quite a significant number of people. It is a lot of people that have active disqualifications. They range in length from maybe 3 months for the minimum offence right through to 4 years, which you can be banned off the road for variety of reasons, and even higher for much more serious offences. You could be banned right up 20 years. So it is a complex situation. People are entitled to hold on to their licence before the court case to hear the court hearing, and then even after they're convicted in court, they have a right to appeal. And under Irish legislation, you must carry your licence at all times. That is the law. So obviously you can leave court with that licence in your hand pending an appeal. It's only after the appeal period of approximately 2 weeks has expired and you haven't lodged appeal or you've lost that appeal that we actually have the right to demand that licence back.
And was there ever an idea that, say, you lost your appeal, that you handed it over there and then?
No, because the law states that you must carry your licence at all times, and the appeal, maybe someone won't show up for an appeal, or maybe the appeal...
No, but if you lose it...
No, the law doesn't require that you hand it into court. The court is not there to interfere with justice as such. The law is that you must surrender your licence after being convicted. It doesn't state that you must hand it in at the court. And that is slightly different. I have heard people suggest that we adopt the same procedure as there is in the North, whereby you must send your licence in before the court hearing. However, I go back to the requirement that you must be carrying your licence with you at all times, and that means that you can't be mandated to surrender it in court. And again, Marion, a lot of these people, they've disregarded the law in the first place by committing the offence that got them in court in the first place. They may already have surrendered that licence on a previous disqualification, because there are still some people surrendering their licence, and it isn't a proxy to say that they're actually driving while disqualified. I think the important thing here is to identify who's actually driving while disqualified. Some people may surrender their license and continue to drive. Some people may not surrender their license, and they do respect the driving ban.
And tell me, what effect does this have on insurance?
Well, insurance companies are required and should be doing proper oversight when someone brings up for their insurance, and they have access to this national driver file as well. They can check someone's penalty point status or if they're holding a valid license or whether they're holding a learner permit. It could be stronger, and absolutely the insurance company on the spot could say to someone, we're not issuing an insurance cert because your license is endorsed, you have a qualification, you have penalty points. However, that really is already known as an issue in that not all insurance companies are doing it. Some are, but not all of them, and it could be much more robust in the oversight on it.
And another question, if you don't have a license, how do you get insurance?
Well, I think that's a very good point, Marion, because a lot of these 10,000 that are disqualified and haven't surrendered their license may have already committed other offences there. No tax, no insurance. They may have been caught breaking the road traffic law for some other reason, dangerous driving, speeding. So generally, our experience is that they could have been multiple offenders at the time. And on research that we have sought from an Garda Síochána, even an example for the number of vehicles that have been seized so far this year for unaccompanied learner driving, we are aware that a significant proportion, almost 60% of those offenders, were detected with associated offences such as driving while holding a mobile phone, no insurance, no tax, defective vehicle. So actually, by and large, as I said to your researcher, there's 2.6 million driver licences in this country, and most people are very compliant with the law.
Right.
It's a small cohort that do break the law, and the only way to stop people like this, and it has happened, is to actually incarcerate them. And the only reason they're stopping driving is because they don't have access to a vehicle. And sadly, that is what we are seeing in road traffic collisions as well. Some small cohort of people are recidivist drivers, and the only way we would have been able to prevent that was to have them incarcerated at the time. And people who continue to drive while disqualified do face that in court. And judges are jailing people who have continually broken the law driven while disqualified. So we do see it prosecuted in court.
Right. Conor, the numbers on these disqualified drivers, it kind of undermines credibility. Ron, I heard them published by your own paper. I thought, here we go again.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit crazy. This cropped up during the week at the Public Accounts Committee. The Garda Commissioner, Drew Harris, was there.
Yeah.
And he was answering, you know, a whole range of questions. And one of the issues that came up was this whole idea of people being banned from driving and then not, you know, surrendering their driver's licence to the RSA. Now, I think it would have come as news to a lot of people that you had to actually send in your driver's licence to the RSA
actually,
when you were banned.
Same here. I would have thought it was the Garda station.
Yeah. So I think in many ways I was surprised the story blew up as it did. I think it's the wrong issue that we're focusing on,
okay.
Really. So as the RSA has said there, half of the people who haven't returned their driver's licences were banned from driving anyway. Okay, so this whole idea of returning their driver's licence, obviously it won't arise for them because they have no driver's licence. So I think the key thing here is that the guards are very ill-prepared to establish who's actually banned from driving when they stop people on the streets, at Garda checkpoints and all of that. And what I mean by that is, in places like England, Scotland, Wales and really all over the world, the police there, they have things like smartphones or iPods or whatever, these handheld electronic items. And they can basically take a car reg, they can tap the car reg into their iPod and they can establish should this driver be on the road, should this car be on the road. So they can assess things like the insurance status of the vehicle, of the driver, the NCT, all of that.
Seems very efficient.
Yes. Now, we've been talking about introducing these things for, I don't know, 20 years maybe, and it still hasn't happened yet. Now, I think there's a bit of light at the end of the tunnel for the guards on this. They've actually trialled a scheme in Limerick earlier in the year, and what that allows Gardaí, it basically gave them these handheld iPods, and they can access the insurance database from these. So if they stop a driver at the roadside, they can tap in the Car Edge and they can establish if this car is insured.
And can they also tap into the one that we were just referring to there with Moya?
The National Driver File. On the Limerick trial, I'm not sure about that, but the plan at the moment is to issue 10,000 of these handheld pads. And when they're issued and the scheme is up and running, in theory, the Gardaí will be able to access all of the information, be it insurance, be it NCT, and all of that. And they'll be able to establish whether the people who they find driving the car are banned or not. So
will that include a broadband issue?
Well, that
it probably can they do.
I guess it probably will. And I mean, I suppose the minute you hear anything involving IT, you straight away in Ireland start to get, you know, worried really, because we don't do technology very well.
We don't, and we did a disaster through the health service. But the Inland Revenue get great credit for a very...
And look at the passport system, which is now online. So yeah, we do it well in some areas. I mean, we spent the morning talking about broadband technology, the most detailed level of technical knowledge, etc., that's out there. And now we're talking about chasing bits of paper around the postal system.
Yeah, Marion, could I just come in?
You certainly may, yeah?
Yeah. No, Connor's correct there. The pilot has been very successful. And just to clarify, the guards will be able to access that information from the NBTF, albeit through their own feed from the system, so they can identify not just disqualified drivers, but they'll also be able to identify whether someone is on a learner permit or a full licence, so they can more effectively detect the unaccompanied learner driver issue as well. But as well as that, the pilot has been very successful, and I am aware from discussions with the Assistant Commissioner for Roads Policing that they have just very recently received approval for the $5 million that they require to roll that out from DEEPR, and that it will be happening, and it cannot happen soon enough because, as the other panellist was saying there, chasing a paper system is just so inefficient. And the requirement to surrender your licence does hark back to the days where you sent a licence in to get a physical endorsement on it and you got it stamped. So times have moved on quickly, and technology is the key to solving this issue. The guards can effectively administer justice on the roadside, whether someone cooperates or not. They will have the access to the visual record as well. They'll be able to tell whether this person is who say they are, and you can see it in action there with some of the tweets that are coming through and Garda Síochána as well from their Twitter feed, that they are catching people who've tried to say they're someone else and they've been found out on the roadside and they felt the long arm of the law there and then. So it is definitely the only way forward. It's the solution that we need, as opposed to trying to introduce further legislation, because the law is very comprehensive at the moment. You are required to bring your license to court. You are required by law to surrender it when you're disqualified. People just decide to break the law.
Well, they just might throw it into a drawer too. I mean, with no malintent,
they may physically lose it. Genuinely, you cannot find it.
Can I come back to you? What did Drew Harris have to say on this issue at the Oireachtas Committee this week?
Yeah, well, he said, I mean, it was quite clear that it wasn't, you know, this whole idea that you had to send in your driver's licence, it clearly wasn't, working. People weren't complying with that. He was unhappy about that. And he basically said, as I say, that there were 2,000 of these pads that Gardaí had, and they were going to distribute a total of 10,000 of them very soon. So I think the key thing here is to keep an eye on whether that actually happens or not. In the past, we've had, you know, lots of promises from the guards on IT. So he's kind of nailed himself down there. He said, we're going to have 10,000 of, you know, these pretty quickly.
That sounds a lot. Is it a lot?
It does sound a lot, but...
You don't think it's a lot,
Well, this, it's one per guard, roughly, isn't it? It's about 10 or 11,000 guards.
Right, yeah, and I mean, bearing in mind that obviously these, 10,000 items won't be in use at the same time. You know, they'll be owned by various Garda members.
Right.
And
I think all guards need to have access.
Pardon?
Sorry, I was going to say, I would like to see all guards, whether they're in the roads policing unit or general policing,
should have
access to that information, because many of these individuals are actually... in the process of committing some other offence when they are caught driving disqualified, it's indicative of further issues there, so it can be very beneficial to have the information to hand while they're administering
general. It certainly would. Can I ask, did you know that you had to give, that you had to post your licence back to the RSA if you got into any difficulty?
No, particularly because they're the new cards now. You would just imagine that they would have been rendered useless if you were disqualified because they are digitally enabled. You know, if you get the new card, not the...
Did you know that?
I did, but Marion, the fear of losing your licence for the people that I know and socialise with, I mean, it would be almost the worst thing that could happen. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And, you know, to even be in that position, I just find it so shocking that there's so many people cruising around the country that are not supposed to be on the road at all. I mean, this harks back to the thing. Was it, Connie, you might know the figure on this, was there 150,000 vehicles on the road without insurance?
Yeah, that's
I mean,
that's
I just find these figures absolutely...
I think just hearing that, my anxiety...
I think they do point to something that's important, because I happen to know, it happened to someone I know who got disqualified from driving and had to post it back to the RSA.
And had you known it was the RSA and not the guards?
Yeah, at that stage that it was. But I think, you know, there's something here that we've got to tackle kind of as a society, because when you talk about issues like road safety, one thing the RSA in particular has done extremely well over the last 15 years is this two-pronged approach of there has to be, on one level, personal responsibility. Yeah. So all of those ads we see about, you know, how to drive responsibly, not speeding, don't be in and out of traffic lanes. And we all, for the vast majority of us, take those on board and go, yeah, I shouldn't be speeding or I should be more responsible. And certain rules work on that basis because we know I have to voluntarily surrender or go with the cards or do something. But increasingly, there is a cohort that's left. And I think it's made up of both a cohort that's left and new younger drivers sometimes coming on the scene as well. That's about enforcement. And they're not getting that personal responsibility message. They're not caring that they shouldn't be on the road, that they're endangering others. And all the messages that have worked so well, I think, for so much of the population, we now have a challenging group, and it is enforcement, and it's going to be down to the guards. And again, going back to the many things we've talked of today, from the cervical to the check to broadband, you know, this is the big things we've got to have as a society. What are we spending money on? Where should we be spending it? Because guards need resources too to do this. They need technology, they need ability and resources. But increasingly, it is shocking, but there is a hardcore of people who don't care, don't see a personal responsibility, and they will drive no matter what. And you can surrender the licence or take it away from them. They'll still chance it and they'll still do it. And catching them or incarcerating them is probably the only way you're going to stop that. Whereas for the majority of people, yes, we play by the rules.
So you're not going to incarcerate 150,000 non-insured vehicles. But
it's just a very good sight out in County Meath, I do believe.
Right, okay.
For another prison.
Yeah, but not 150,000, I would think. I mean,
incarceration doesn't seem like the right...
The technology, a fine, and first of all, you got to be able to pinpoint them on the spot, and straight away a fine. And I think money talks.
I mean,
impounding vehicles as well, because you can't drive if you don't have a car.
Yeah. Yeah.
So physically taking away the vehicle, I think, is something that shocks people into, and the temptation. Mm. And then, you know, if you paid for that car, that's a serious sanction financially.
I think the big issue here,
I would have to agree, and actually, I would just like to accentuate the positive in that Ireland's roads have become much safer over the past 15 years.
They have, that was just said.
The majority of people comply with the law and take responsibility and take personal responsibility. And I'd just like the message to get out that the net is closing on that small cohort, as your panellist said, who continue to break the law with disregard and think that they'll get away with it. And I think it is so important to get the investment into and Garda Síochána, because you can see how effective it is.
I think impounding the car sounds like a very good idea. Because it would really hurt, and it would also mean you couldn't drive. But anyway, Conor, Drew Harris was in there. It's his first appearance, I do believe, or second.
Before the Public Accounts Committee, it's his first, I think.
Yeah. He's very new in the job. How is it too early to assess him?
It probably is a bit too early to assess him. He took up the job at the beginning of September, and one of the key things for him was that he came into the job after a period of a lot of controversy, really, for the
Absolutely,
past 5 or 6
yeah.
years, really. So he came into office at the same time that the Commission on the Future of Policing in Ireland published its report. And that's really, you know, they took a really hard look at An Garda Síochána for a year. That was chaired by Kathleen O'Toole.
Yeah.
She's a former police chief from the US, and she's the former head of the Garda Inspectorate here in Ireland. So her commission...
There have been quite a number of studies into the Gardaí and what might be done to them, with them, by them.
I mean, ironically, Kathleen O'Toole was the head of the Garda Inspectorate, as I say. If a lot of the reports that had been issued by the Garda Inspectorate while she was the head of it had been acted on, we probably wouldn't have needed to bring her back and chair up this commission. But anyway, their report was published as Drew Harris came into office. And really his job will be to execute that report. They issued an implementation report there towards the end of last year on that. And really, over the next 12 months, we'll begin to see the complexion of the changes that are going to take place. I mean, there's a whole load of, you know, recommendations.
There were complaints this week about the Gardaí investigating themselves, and he was quite defensive about that. Now, the name Sergeant McCabe comes to mind. You know, that wasn't handled very well from within the organisation, to put it mildly.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that was handled very poorly. But I suppose what Drew Harris said during the week was that he was going to establish an anti-corruption unit in the Guards. And this is a completely new thing for An Garda Síochána, because what he said was they're not going to wait for complaints to come in. They're going to go out and look for it. So they're going to take a very proactive approach in trying to find a very broad range of corruption in the Guards.
Right.
And his when people asked him, you know, is it a good idea to have Gardaí investigating Gardaí?
Yeah.
He felt it was okay as long as the oversight agencies, people like the Garda Síochána Ombudsman, were aware of the inquiries that were going on. Because once people like the Garda Ombudsman, which is independent of on Garda Síochána, once they're aware of inquiries going on internally within the Guards, they have oversight.
And
they
does that include GSOC?
That is GSOC. That's the Garda Ombudsman.
So,
as I say, Drew Harris, he said they're going to proactively go out and look for Garda corruption, which is really a new concept.
Are we in line of duty territory here?
Yeah, I mean, he's not setting himself up for a quiet period in office. I think if he's going to set up that kind of unit, if they're going to take that attitude, that they're going to be very proactive. He's going to find things that maybe other Garda commissioners didn't really want to find. And I think the whole concept of Gardaí investigating Gardaí, it was a very bad concept years ago when we had an organisation called the Garda Complaints Board. And the Garda Complaints Board was a very strange organisation in that it issued an annual report every year and it complained about the fact that it couldn't do its job properly. It didn't have the powers. It had to ask Gardaí to go and carry out inquiries on its behalf.
Yes.
They all took very long and so on. It's slightly different now in that we have agencies like the Garda Inspectorate, which basically reviews aspects of Garda police work, and it will examine them and it will come up with a recommendation for change in the Guards. And we also have the Garda Ombudsman, which basically investigates complaints about individual Garda members. So if you have those two layers there, I think you can have an anti-corruption bureau within An Garda Síochána, as long as GSOC, the Garda Ombudsman, is aware of the inquiries that are going on and it can check into them and have oversight.
Now, I presume the people that were in that office before would say there wasn't anything that they didn't want to see. They wanted to see everything, but that's just to put their point of view. Listen, Conor, thank you very, very much indeed for that. That's Conor Lally, Crime and Security Editor with the Irish Times, and Moya Murdoch, CEO of the Road Safety Authority.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
In this weekend's Sunday Business Post, is the government throwing taxpayers' money away? Stephen Kinsella asks if the National Broadband Plan is worth the cash. Don't miss our exclusive competition to see Ireland play Samoa at the Rugby World Cup, and get your free copy of our little book of Irish home design. The Sunday Business Post, independent journalism on Sunday.
Don't miss a beat. Take care of your heart, because you could have atrial fibrillation, a type of irregular heartbeat that can cause a stroke and is more common the older you get. It's easy to get checked. Talk to your doctor. For more information, visit keepthebeat.ie. Brought to you by Pfizer and Bristol Myers Squibb.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco, providing free delivery for everyone 65 or older when you shop online. Tesco, every little helps.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, we haven't been going at Brexit very much, but the consequences of it are pretty startling at the moment in Britain. Britain's rich prepared to flee what they call Corbageddon. In other words, they're taking their money out if they're asked to pay any more tax. Poll surge for Farage sparks panic in the Tories. Dara, you had a look at that.
I did, yeah. I mean, I just... so amazed that Nigel Farage is still a credible person in UK politics.
Because a lot of people agree with him.
Yeah, well, yeah, but, like, you know, all the stuff that he spouted during the referendum have been, you know, proven. All the numbers he was talking about, the savings for the NHS, that, you know, it would result in X, Y and Z, have been proven lies, untrue. Yeah. And are not going to happen. And I'm just amazed that the British public, there's still so much support for him. And in the same paper, it was interesting that when you got into the middle of the paper, there was a big special report on mixed race Britain. And this is kind of on the back of Archie,
the baby,
Harrison,
yeah.
Mountbatten, Windsor. Have I got all the names in there, right? who, of course, has mixed race, you know, ancestors. And, you know, Brexit, I can't figure it out. Is it a reaction to, you know, immigrants coming in and taking the jobs and all the rest of it? What do they really want? They don't know.
But
we don't know.
A lot of people, and people who were Remainers have said this. Not everybody who voted to leave was a racist.
Sure.
You know, they weren't. There was a whole mixture
Economic reasons put in front of them, but all the
cultural reasons.
Yeah,
Britannia rules the waves.
Sure,
that kind of thing.
Even on the economics, and Colin will be strong on this, but I mean, you know, the economic reasons have been proved to be largely nonsensical, and like I'm amazed as somebody who does a bit of business exporting flowers into Holland. They actually all go through the land bridge in the UK, and it's a perishable product, and it's in a truck, and if it hits delays at ports, it's going to be a disaster. And how do we send bonded trucks? Then you have to have a full truck, and of course I may not always have enough flowers to fill a truck, so then you have to find a different route. Like, these are the little things that me as a small farmer just doing my own little enterprise, like, sure, there's only like a handful of farmers in the country growing fresh flowers that send them out of the country. Like, beef and dairy are the big gorillas, you know, in this context. But, you know, Brexit is forcing Ireland to pivot away from Britain, its strongest trading partner. It's forcing the likes of the Glanbia, the whole dairy industry, to invest in everything but cheddar. And that's happening. And I think a lot of businesses have contingency plans where when Brexit happens, they press the button and suddenly it's a whole new world, and I think that's going to hit Britain even harder, and they don't realise this yet.
And it's such a tragedy. We were talking to Henneman Charles yesterday and about Mo Mollum and about leading up to the Good Friday Agreement and all the good things that came out of that, including very good Anglo-Irish relations, and it's taken a hammering. Sinead, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, just on probably to answer that question and Dara's first question about how Nigel Farage is still a person in politics in Britain. And I was sitting on this panel, I think it was probably 2016, when one Colin McCarthy said and bemoaned the absolute lack of talent in Westminster. And that, I think, is one of the reasons, if not the main reason, why we're here now and why the past year has happened as it is. Nobody has the talent or the political acumen. I think Nigel Farage has a lot of political acumen in a way that the people who need to have it on the front benches of Labour and the front benches of the Conservative Party absolutely do not. And they have left this vast gap that ensures people like Nigel Farage fill it with whatever guff and nonsense he fills it with, but which speaks to the people in a way that politicians should
that
speak
they connect,
to people.
They connect.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm a piece in The Guardian yesterday, which was quoted as saying, you don't need, in relation to particularly the leadership stampede, it appears, for the Tory party leadership at the moment, and there's about 10 runners and riders that are about to declare. And the quote was, you don't need to be great to hear the call of greatness, because there's a an awful lot of people believing that they have that ability to be great in that exalted position of Prime Minister that perhaps don't have the talent. And I think that is a major issue. That's you know, we can look at it as a sort of political gamesmanship from this side of the water, but ultimately, come October, if Theresa May is not in position, and it will go back to lastminute.com in terms of the negotiations.
It was completely farcical,
and it will happen again, Marianne, because there will be a new Prime Minister, I believe, in place at that point, who will not
bite the bullet.
Who will perhaps bring it to the edge? But if that's a Brexit here, they may just leap over the cliff.
Colm?
Sinead reminded everybody that this has been visible for a few years now, and I do think that the quality of the frontline politicians in both the Conservative and Labour parties is lower than I can remember. And to be clear on that, I don't believe that people like Jim Callaghan or Margaret Thatcher or Dennis Healey or those kind of folks, they wouldn't have walked the country into this mess. They were too smart. Thatcher was against referendums, incidentally. It's very revealing that the right-wing Tories who adore and venerate Lady Thatcher and quote her when it suits them about all sorts of stuff, they never quote her on the question of referendums. And Margaret was Prime Minister for 11 years. She didn't have any referendums on Europe for 11 years, right, even though she was pretty Euro-sceptical at the
Well,
end.
She gave them a lot of grief in Europe, but wasn't she very keen on free trade?
She also can claim, not exclusively really, the authorship of the single market that these fellas want to get out of. I'd love to be interviewing Rees-Mogg or some of these guys. I think the BBC has done a terrible bad job in dealing with these people. But to get back to Sinead's point, the real damage that's been done is not really the pros and cons of would we like to have more sovereignty or how's it going to work out on trade and all that. The treachery was the following. To pretend to people that leaving the European Union after 45 years is simple.
Yeah.
That was the real treachery. Yeah. That is a terrible thing.
They had a referendum as if they were deciding whether to join rather than to leave.
They had a referendum as if they were about to resign from the world whale and dolphin appreciation society or something, you know?
They didn't. And, you know, I think one of the things that's sometimes missed with Brexit is this. It's interesting sometimes when you step back and you look at political systems, and I think a lot of what's happened in Brexit is a victim of what their system. I mean, we were always led, as I was growing up, and you're looking at political systems, that in Ireland where we have proportional representation...
We're perfect.
...small parties. Well, you'd be led to be perfect, but the great weakness in our system was always that it allows small groups to actually lead
Absolutely,
and give them voice.
Absolutely, but that's kind of heretical.
Yeah, but if you go into Britain, the great power of Britain when you looked at their system was, when you're being fair about it and you're looking at systems, you said, well, Britain, no matter what, the vote, you know, as they have the straight vote, allows them to have pretty much a two-party system. So when you hit crisis, interesting, go back to the financial crisis. One of the interesting things was, because of our voting system, like several other countries, we had something of a political meltdown happened, you know, after the election and all that, and the parties changed. And you looked at Britain, and Britain had two big parties, Labour, Conservatives. Because of this system, it's able to keep the small parties out, so you couldn't shift that block. And that's the whole idea of the straight vote. It allows you to ensure that the system survives any kind of threat. And only in recent years have we now begun to see the frailty within that system. Because what then happened after a while it oversaw that financial crisis, yeah, it wasn't able to cope with these small bubbles of very strong opinion that began to pop up across Britain. And that resulted in, exactly as Colm says, there should never have been a referendum that was simplified like that. But because the system of the two big parties with no other outlet, no other way of influencing it, it forced a situation where then Cameron got it wrong, went for a referendum, but that was out of the system. And now you're seeing a meltdown of the Tory party
about Cameron,
because they still don't have the ability to deal with it.
I agree with the thesis that what he did was wrong. But Brussels didn't really try to help him.
No, they didn't. And look, Brussels is always at the... They have the view of Europe. And Brussels is Brussels. I mean, you could argue, too, that Brussels wasn't a huge help in terms for Ireland. You know, when
you
we
could.
Were there, we were...
You certainly could.
Brussels will always do what Brussels does best, which is look after the European project. That's its aim. That's what it does. Individual countries fight their corner within that by building alliances. Britain, Cameron saw it at a moment of weakness in Europe to, because Europe was being torn apart over the Greek, the Irish bailouts, he was going to get a deal special for Britain. That wasn't well received. It didn't go down well and he got caught out. But now we're seeing the Tory party collapsing. And again, it's down to this, the fear of Corbyn, the things that have happened in Labour. It's because the system cannot actually allow a certain amount of smaller views, minority views, rise to the top and have sway at least for a period of time. It can't cope with that.
OK, mind you, to come back to Brussels, if you talk to somebody who's involved in Brussels, I'm like stuck record on this, they always take the view that the system in Brussels is the best system going. I never seem to connect that with the fact that a lot of citizens in Europe don't necessarily agree with them. And Paddy Agnew is writing today in the Sunday Independent about what's happening in Italy. And what's going to happen in the next European Parliament is anybody's guess.
Yeah, a lot of the thinking, I think, in that Europe does its best is that they take away a lot of the boring stuff. So we don't hear about European Parliament stuff and we don't have to worry about it because it takes a lot of the boring stuff away from us and away from governance. But in that, going back to like leaving those gaps, it also just leaves you fingers to point. You can just point your fingers
and
at that.
And it's this vacuum, isn't there?
That's, you know, that's where the problem is.
I was coming home from a hurling match last night and some of my in-laws were in the car. And they had no idea who was running in the between the whole lot of us. We couldn't name the existing all the sitting MEPs. And you know, one of them said to me, "Well, sure, you know, they've nothing to do with me.
Okay.
I'm not a farmer."
Okay,
which is kind of shocking.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, we're not covering the elections at the moment because you have to during these things get absolute balance, 100% stopwatches, all that kind of thing. Anyway, thank you very, very much indeed, and we will take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
The Verdi Requiem, one of the fiercest pieces in all classical music, blazing against death with moments of incredible power and heartbreaking beauty. Hear it live with the RTE National Symphony Orchestra, the RTE Philharmonic Choir and four top voices with conductor Michele Mariotti. An experience you don't want to miss. Friday the 17th of May at the National Concert Hall. Tickets from £28.50. See rte.ie/nso.
The RTE National Symphony Orchestra. Love your orchestras.
Mojo Fest in association with RTE is back. And, you know, it's not just for professional mobile content creators. Are you a startup trying to find your voice on social? Or a small business looking for new ways to tell your story? With the right inspiration, a few apps and a little training, you can create professional visual stories and 360 content armed simply with the phone in your pocket. June 6th to 8th at NUIG Galway. See mojofest.eu. Mojo Fest 2019 in association with RTE.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, I'm joined in studio by the weight loss expert, Dr. Ava Osmond, and Olympic boxer Mick Dowling, who are starring in a new two-part series called How to Live Better for Longer. Ava, you noticed in other parts of the world people live nearly 10 years. Do they really live 10 years longer than we do in Ireland?
It's almost there. Japan. I have had this obsession with Japan for quite some time. And, you know, long life expectancy. But I think it's more important just the number life expectancy. I think it's how we live those last years. Because obviously, I don't have seen the figures, but we have huge amount of chronic disease in Ireland. And it's mainly due to the lifestyle that we are leading. We are.
And your thesis is you look after yourself very carefully, and you always did.
Yeah, no, yes. I try to have a balance, but I have, you know, I very much follow the 80-20 rule, you know. 80% of the time I try to be good, and then there's those 20%, which is not that good. But I try to keep it up, you know, because really, what is more important for us than our health is our wealth in the end of the day.
Of course.
And you see, I've always been sort of giving out to people and being quite strong about the message. And I just felt that we would need a more fresh, scientific, a little bit more entertaining approach to this through inspiring people, because this is something I need to continuously. I tend to have that little devil that goes on my left shoulder and try to say to me, don't go there and don't do the vegetables. And, you know, like, you have to fight it. And obviously, it's, we need inspiration. And
Is it partially because you dread growing old?
You see, yeah, I really do. I'm a little bit more positive about this now after doing the two-hour documentary. But yeah, no, I don't really like the idea, because I feel I feel in my 20s or 30s, whatever is more looking elegant. And it's just, you know, when you start seeing the wrinkles, that sort of wakes me up sometimes. But I don't feel any way different than I felt when I was on my 20s.
I can't see any wrinkles, so I presume...
There aren't any.
You're very upfront. You took Botox straight away.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I wanted to become a plastic surgeon. You know, that was my first passion when I went into medicine.
I don't think you could do it to yourself.
I'm going to take it, all the help I can get, because I think this is also part of mental health, because who is watching you first thing in the morning in the mirror is yourself. You know, if you can't love yourself, how can you love anybody else? And it's not selfish love, of course. It's, you know, to be comfortable. And, you know, in today's world, there's so much competition, and, you know, we are send all these messages on Instagram, Twitter, you know, you tend to easily compare yourself to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to try to keep the, you know, we have this saying,
right.
I love sayings, you know, if the cat doesn't lift its own tail, who does?
Right. But you're adamant that we're quite ageist as well.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you look at the media, you look at the movies, you know, what's there? It's young people, you know.
Yeah.
Having sex, you know, looking loving, looking lovely clothing. So I suppose this is changing now. You can see, you know, L'Oreal and all these big companies are
because
now investing in you know, Jane Fonda and older women to sort of sell their product.
Yeah.
They've seen that, you know, actually this third phase, these over 50s are actually
a
big market.
We were watching something last night, actually, and one of the things we commented on, there was an older couple, so, I don't know, they were in their 70s, maybe early 80s, and they were kissing, but they just showed them giving each other a peck on the cheek, and I was like, geez, would they not let them kiss on the lips? It's like, what's going on?
Talk to the director.
Anyway.
Mick, you looked the picture of health as well, and you were very keen on sports from an early stage.
Marion, I suppose, yeah, I was lucky I discovered sport at a very, very young age, and sport has been part of my life ever since, you know, and in my family, it's sport all the time. It's smelly runners, it's sweaty gear, absolutely all of the time. And I was a very young boy in Castlecomer in Kilkenny. Growing up, it was hurling, it was cross-country running, track running, road running, and a little bit of boxing in those early days. And I've continued it ever since. And as I said, I've been lucky to discover sport. And, I, you know, perhaps I was fairly good at it. But it
I
wasn't
think perhaps fairly, you were, yeah.
But a lot of it was, Marion, because I used to train so, so hard, you know.
You and emigrated to Dublin,
I did. I often say that I emigrated up here to the Big Smoke when I was only about 16 years old. Was playing hurling here in Dublin with the hurling team, and because I was from Kilkenny, they thought I was brilliant.
Naturally,
so they had me taking the frees and the 50s and the sideline balls.
They actually moved to the small pond to be the big fish.
they thought I was going to be good at everything, but I started serious boxing though. I'd done a little bit as a kid, of course, but serious boxing when I was 17, and that came about because I ran a cross country race, and it was Leinster Championship. I'd finished about sixth, I think, but I was still young enough the next year. So I said, right, sixth this year, I'm going to win it next year. But that next year I didn't. I finished about 10th down the field.
Oh.
And I was crying. And I mean crying. You know, I'm well able to cry when I lose, especially when I lose, because I hate losing. And I always wanted to win. So my brother said to me then, he said, look, why don't you give up that running, he said. And I guarantee you, he said, in 2 years I'll have you on the Irish boxing team. Now, that was a mad thing to say, you know, that in 2 years you'd be on an Irish boxing team. I joined Arbor Hill Boxing Club. The boys in the Gresham Hotel where I worked said, oh, go up to Arbor Hill, it's a good club. I remember well, on the 10th of March, 1965, knocked on the door. It was a big green door, big bottle green door. Man called Mr. Byrne, Jim Byrne, but he was Mr. Byrne to me at that time. Opened the door. I said, hello, son, come on in. He said, what's your name? And I said, Michael Dowling, you know. Oh, you're up. Did you ever box before, son? I'd done a little bit. That was the start of my boxing in Arbor Hill. I said, that was 10th of March, 65. October 67, I got my first international, as my brother had promised. And a year later, I was off to Mexico.
Wow. Extraordinary story.
So there you are.
Yeah, really, really.
But in the meantime, I need to find out who the Botox expert is. With Dr. Eva. We all want to get the name and address or phone number of that person.
The boxing... you know, teaching you gave me while we were doing the programme, I have to say, that was a little bit tough. I was a little worried because I have a 2 rotator cuff operations last year and I was like, how am I going to... And I was really trying, but amazing people boxing, they're all ages and really, I didn't even know all how full body exercise that boxing is.
Well, you know, a lot of them now, Marion, are coming, guys that are playing hurling and they're playing football, soccer, rugby, Gaelic, they're playing other sports and athletics and they're coming to complement their training for those sports with boxing because it's such an overall fitness thing.
Right.
And you get a really, really good workout. Yeah.
And they're not coming to box?
No. We opened it. My daughter, Lisa, opened this gym at the KCR called Evolve. And we opened it because people were coming to my boxing club, Mount Talent Boxing Club, asking to join, but they didn't want to box. So then we thought, well, look, we'll open a club that'll cater for people like that, people that are well past fighting and competing days, and or even youngsters who don't want to box, or their mammies or daddies don't want them to box.
Yeah.
And as an ex-fighter, I can well understand that.
Yeah.
But come up here to the KCR gym where you don't get hit, and that's very appealing.
That would matter an awful lot to me.
To a lot of people. Yeah. Yeah.
Colin, would you be interested?
Yeah. Well, it hasn't saved Mick from wrinkles. I can see them from here, and I'm right
thank
across
you, Colin.
The table. But there's something that always intrigues me about longevity, and it's a fact that throughout the Western world, the average age at which people depart this planet has been going up.
Yeah.
And the life expectancy at birth in Ireland now, it must have gone up 5 or 6 years since the Second World War, which is a lot, and it's gone up more for women. Women live longer.
It's gone like 10 years since 1970.
It's 10, yeah.
Yeah.
And women live longer than men because they're spoiled, as you know.
I let you finish.
and this is regularly described...
1, 2, 3, there are 4 women here.
That's regularly described as progress.
This is regularly described... by demographers and economists and people like that, as a demographic crisis. And it's a phrase that really annoys me. And they rattle on and say, oh, your population is aging. There's a demographic crisis. And the implication is that if they all snuffed it tomorrow, should that be terrific? You know, that'd be a demographic bonus.
Save the exchequer.
Save the exchequer. But the problem is, it's quite interesting. I'd be intrigued of what Mick thinks about this. In the last few years here, and in quite a lot of other countries, the participation rate in the workforce in the older age groups has begun to creep up. And it fell for a long time. I mean, the pension age in Ireland, you know, was 70 back in the 1960s and 70s.
So you'd be well out of it.
And then some politicians, I'd make it 69, the other creditors 60, and it went down to 60. Now it's going back up again.
But can I...
What has that got to do with you boxing?
The following. People are fitter.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just that people are older, they're fitter in the older age groups.
I wouldn't totally agree with you on that, you know?
Well, they're fitter than when they had physical work, though.
We're told it's an obesity crisis, right?
Yeah, but if it's a demographic, disaster that, you know, there's so much older people, why is it a disaster? Because it's costing a lot to the society in terms of the chronic conditions that we are treating. I mean, in Ireland alone, we are spending 10% of the health budget for the treatment of one single lifestyle, which is mainly lifestyle disease, type 2 diabetes.
Yes,
I mean, it's pretty extraordinary that 150 million goes just for the drugs of this disease, which actually could be in most cases reversed by lifestyle changes. So but 1 million Irish people are suffering from a chronic conditions, and 65% over the 65 age group have two chronic conditions. So I think, you know, we have to be reminded about this, because yes, we might be living longer, but we are paying the price to treat these people who are they fully enjoying their life? Third phase, which in my consideration isn't the best part of our lives, and especially after interviewing all these experts in the course of making this program, I'm a little bit more positive about aging now, because this is supposed to be my best years are still to come if I look after myself.
I understand the point, but it's notable that reality has broken through. We used to have a pension system which said if you live to be 65, we'll give you a fine pension. That's cool as long as you agree to snuff it at 67. But if people decide to hang around until they're 95 and a half...
And going up and boxing in his gym or his daughter's gym.
The system goes bust. And particularly if people have lifestyle-induced illnesses and all that. But the only way to square the circle is that people are going to keep working as long as they're fit.
Well, you know,
that's happening, isn't it?
I'm 72 years old now, and people say, "What are you still working? Why aren't you retired?" Why would I retire? I don't want to retire, you know? Yeah, I'm 72. I go into my sports shop every single day. And to me, that's not work. I go to my gym five, six nights a week. That's not work. You know, I coach youngsters. I coach older people.
Do you work out 6 days a week?
Do I work out? Well, Eva Saad, my workout is working out with the youngsters, giving them pads and bag work. I'm constantly on the go, you know, all of the time. But I'm just coming from the Terenure 5 mile road race just this morning. And if anyone ever needed any convincing that having an athletic lifestyle is good for you, I met a man there this morning called Harry Gorman. Harry would be famous in Irish sport. He is, in 2 months' time, he'll celebrate his 90th birthday. He's a man that competed for Ireland in European championships, big championships all over the world. And he's there this morning, 2 months short of his 90th birthday, and he's like a young fella going around. So that convinces
me
too.
And I met a lot of people like that in the course of making this documentary, like that on their 70s, they run, on their early 80s, they still go to the gym all the time. But the question here is that, are these people some superheroes, or are these people actually doing what we all should
do? No, Eva, they have lived the lifestyle. I met Katrina McKiernan, battled it out with the young ones this morning, and she finished close. Katrina, 21 years ago, she won the London Marathon. She's now, must be just on 50 years old, and she's still so, so fit. And I know that the likes of her and the likes of Sonia Sullivan and the likes of Eamon Coughlin will always stay in shape, because that's been the lifestyle.
What about the rest of us? What about the rest of us that aren't elite athletes? And I think that is the challenge. I mean, we've got to keep moving. And our lifestyles now are all about the car, the desk, the iPhone, the telly, you know, and unless we can actually start moving more, we are destined to have a pretty miserable life.
I'm just going to plug something really quickly. A friend of mine who just finished his battle with cancer and is well, thank God, Guy O'Leary, he's taken on a challenge to swim a mile a day for the whole of May, and he's asked some of us to do it. So my mile is on the 15th of May. So I've had to kind of relearn how to swim, because I'm not a good swimmer. I hate when my head underwater.
And the cold.
But in the process of it, I've been in loads of different pools, public pools in Dublin, because I'm not a member of anywhere. So I've been trying to like go to each one that I'm close to every day. And the amount of older people I've seen who are swimming and who get into the pool, and I'm trying to, like, I got to 50 lengths yesterday, and I'm trying to kind of get 10 more each day I'm there. And they are cruising by me. And I'm in my early 30s, and there's these people who are in their 70s and 80s. Mm. And it's amazing to see, but I think it's what Alison said. You need to normalise that and make it friendly and accessible.
Yeah, and push it
again,
on the running
again, go back to the theme of the day, technology. If you're measuring your steps and you're moving your steps up every day, and you were getting to the point where you know, and you can look at your phone and say, do you know something? I actually sat on the couch for 4 hours today. You can measure that and then decide to do less of that and more of walking the next day.
I was quite shocked to learn that inactivity is now considered the same level of risk factor as smoking.
Okay. Can you tell me when it's on?
tomorrow night, 9:30 on RT1. Excellent. And the following Monday.
We have a party political broadcast coming up, so I have to be out a little earlier than normal. So may I thank everybody who contributed to the programme very, very much indeed. And we go on to say that today's show was produced by Rachel Graham. The researchers are Lisa McGough and Rachel Breslin, and broadcasting coordinator is Louise Toll. On sound, Dave Gibson. Series producer, Margaret Curley. Talk to you next week, 11 to 1, Saturday and Sunday. Until then, a very good day to you.